Craig.
Okay.
It's pronounced C-R-A-I-G.
Okay.
That's...
Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court have been pronounced and are posted in the clerk's office for your review. This morning there are three clauses set for oral submission. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Jose Luis Lerma Alvarado versus Farah Manufacturing Company Incorporated from El Paso County. Harold W. Criswell versus European Crossroads Shopping Center Limited from Dallas County. And John Damon and others versus Ray Cornett from Brazoria County. We will complete the argument in each of these three causes before we take our lunch recess, but we'll have a brief recess in between the presentation of each cause. Counsel in the second and third causes are asked to remain nearby, but you do not have to remain in the courtroom while the matters before you are being presented. Counsel in each cause are advised that we are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court, and you may make application to the clerk's office to listen to the tapes of these arguments if you desire to do so. In the first cause, Alvarado versus Farah Manufacturing, the petitioner has 25 minutes to present oral argument, the respondent has 25 minutes to present oral argument, and the petitioner will have 10 minutes for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Professor Patrick Cable will present argument for the petitioner.
Let me say one more thing. Justice Doggett is recused from this case, but will be sitting in the other cases. May I proceed?
May it please the court, counsel, as they announced, my name is Patrick Hazel. I'm here to represent the plaintiff or petitioner in this cause. There are two primary questions in this case that the Court of Appeals decided were both errors on the part of the trial court and were reversible errors. Those are the things that I propose to speak to primarily. The first regards the calling of a witness, Arambide. This witness was not named when interrogatories were answered. And I see there are four questions that are of primary importance that this court needs to look at. First of all, and I'm going to state them from a positional point of view. I think, first of all, the interrogatories were answered properly. Secondly, if they weren't answered properly, there was good cause not to answer them the way, or not to give this particular person's name in the answer. If that's not true, then we get to two points that are maybe even of greater importance, and that is the situation this court has not had to face yet with respect to so-called rebuttal witnesses, and whether or not with them another good cause test might ought to apply. And finally, if there was error all over the place, whether it was reversible error. I say that I believe the interrogatories were answered properly. I think we need to look at both interrogatories. The first interrogatory, and they were back-to-back interrogatories, number one and number two. The first one inquired about persons having knowledge of the occurrences made the basis of this suit. Now, I assume the court has already known this was a wrongful discharge because of filing a workers' comp claim. I haven't gone into all of that with the court. If the court would like for me to, I'll be glad to outline those facts, but otherwise I think we just waste time doing it. That question did not ask for knowledge of or persons having knowledge of relevant facts or discoverable facts, but very particular facts. And it asked about persons having knowledge of the occurrences made the basis of this lawsuit. It's our position that this one witness, Ms. Arambide, did not need to be answered with respect to that interrogatory because she knew nothing about the occurrences made the basis of this lawsuit. And her testimony in the record covers some 16 pages, about five of them are objections about it, but it covers 16 pages of a statement of facts of over 357 pages. She shows in there that she knows nothing of, she didn't even know the plaintiff, nor anything about what happened to the plaintiff. So she was not a person who had any knowledge of the occurrences made the basis of this lawsuit. The second question is the one that I think the court is going to have to look at more closely. And that is, after asking for all persons having knowledge, it says then, for the plaintiff to name each potential witness that you may use in the trial of this case. Well, I wish I could say that the plaintiff objected to that interrogatory as improper discovery, but they didn't. So under the court's interpretation, if you don't object, you make discoverable what's not discoverable. Because we know that finding out who you may call as lay witnesses is not part of our discussion. Experts are. But I first of all say that the answer to that interrogatory simply referred back to the answer to the first. In the first interrogatory, the plaintiff gave five names and addresses of persons. All of those were, in fact, called at the case. As a matter of fact, one other one was called in the case in chief, but there was no objection to that witness, and I think it was probably because it was one of the defendant's witnesses. The defendant was going to call, and they were simply called and declared to be adverse, and they were allowed to cross-examine. Of the witnesses that did testify, three of them were that way. All were, only, as a matter of fact, only two were really the plaintiff and the woman, Noemi Perez, who lived with the plaintiff, were the only two that really were plaintiff's witnesses in the sense that the court did not allow, or that the plaintiff's attorney had to conduct direct examination as opposed to cross-examination leading questions. But those were answered with respect to the first, and the second answer simply referred to that. Now, I say that there is the problem here, it seems to me, that there was a clear ambiguity in this question. Now, the court may say, well, if there's an ambiguity, you better object to that ambiguity. That's like Dallas Independent School District versus Gutierrez. They had some problems with the question, but you didn't object to it, and that may be the problem, one of the problems here in saying why it should have been answered. But it appears, when you look at the two questions back to back, that first you're asking, who knows the facts of the occurrences, and of those, who are you going to call to testify? And I think that's probably, that's exactly what the plaintiff's response was, or petitioner's response. These are, I'm going to call all. It just said refer back to number one, thinking you were asking who I was going to call with respect to that. If we go beyond that, though, let's say that the court says, no, we're going to read those two separately. We're not going to put them together, even though the first one says all persons and the other says each that you plan to call. We're going to read those separately and should have objected. Did the plaintiff have good cause not to answer it? Well, I think the ambiguity, if that's a reasonable interpretation, you either have to say, well, you must object, or if you answer a question that is ambiguous and you give it a reasonable answer, you have good cause why you didn't answer it differently. I think that in all candor with the court, I believe there's some real value in that. But I think it's probably weaker in all candor. And you always hate to say that before a court. Then you get cited, well, counsel admitted that that wasn't good. Well, I'm not admitting it wasn't good. I'm just saying it's weaker than the other arguments is what I'm really saying.
Or that you're in less candor later on.
Well, I guess that's always a fair interpretation. That's another ambiguous thing, I guess you could say. I need to object to that. But there is the question of why was this witness called? I think it's quite clear plaintiff did not intend and did not call this witness during the plaintiff's case in chief. Now, I think that I've heard this stated by lawyers, and it may have even been one of the statements was made during the objections and replies to the objections, that, well, this is a rebuttal witness. Well, I think we all know that just because someone is rebuttal, if you're supposed to reveal them, you're supposed to reveal them and not hide someone. If they know relevant facts, they know relevant facts. Where are you going to use them to start with or not? But the question didn't ask about that. The question had asked, who do you plan to call, or who might you call as a witness in this case? Plaintiff didn't plan to call this person. Now, she was subpoenaed along with several others in the event something should arise.
Well, how can you seriously argue that if a witness is subpoenaed prior to trial that you'd not think about calling, at least not a potential witness?
Well, and that's partly, Your Honor, why I'm saying that I think the first argument that you didn't need to answer them at all is weak. I think there is a, you know, because you subpoenaed some, I don't think that indicates you aren't. Well, apparently in this case the defendant had subpoenaed some people they didn't call. The plaintiff subpoenaed two they had a name, didn't call.
But this is potential witnesses.
That's right.
Surely everyone who is subpoenaed is a potential witness.
I agree with you fully. And if that question is read separately from number one, so you're not thinking that it, well, you're asking me which of those that I've named am I going to call, I'm going to call them all. But if you're asking me separately, who are the potential witnesses in this case that could possibly be called separate, then clearly, Adam Bele is one of those potential witnesses. I don't think there's any question about it if it's read in that fashion. And that's a fair reading of the question. I'm just saying that the two questions put together like that create some ambiguity. But what happened at the trial? Let's suppose that we were to decide, yeah, you should have named the person. You didn't have good cause not to name this person. Now we get to what happens at trial. And the Court of Appeals, I think, uses a phrase that is a well-chosen phrase, probably not complete in itself, but they wanted to said, was there an unexpected development at trial? Well, I know this court is getting leery of stating phrases like that. Anytime you say that, everybody said, oh, this was unexpected. Well, I think we have to add to that, was it reasonably unexpected? Did you have any basis, any solid objective basis that you didn't expect this to happen? Not just telling me I didn't expect that. Well, I think they did. The plaintiff had taken the deposition of Mark Ross, and the deposition we checked to make sure, because I want to be sure it was here. It is in the record before the court. Mark Ross was the person who sat at the defense counsel's table and was the representative of the defendant at the trial. And Mark Ross was not called by the plaintiff. Mark Ross was called by the defendant. I'm going to go back to first or mention a statement, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I have it back here, that the Court of Appeals said when it was really talking about the error factor, but I think it goes something here too. And they said there just was no direct testimony at all in this case that the filing of a workers' compensation case was a determining factor in terminating, or in, they said, the alleged wrongful termination. Well, they're absolutely right. And I would be willing to bet if you have a million of those cases, you're not going to get any direct testimony that they were fired because they filed a workers' comp case. If they ever find that, that won't be a smoking gun. That'll be an exploding neutron device against the defendant. I mean, they're not going to come out and say, now let's have a meeting and we're firing because he filed a workers' comp claim. Nobody's going to say, and they're sure not going to put it in their records anyway. Plaintiff is going to have to come up with circumstances that reasonably infer that's what happened, upon which a jury can base the conclusion that under those circumstances, the circumstantial evidence is that that's what happened. Now, what was plaintiff relying on? Well, plaintiff had plaintiff's testimony and the testimony of a Noemi Pettis. What they, in essence, said, plaintiff said, I was injured on the job, or wasn't injured, it was a sickness that he was claiming had been caused by the work-related illness, really, rather than just a job injury like falling or that sort of thing. And he went to a lawyer. He took off his work was in June, I believe it was, in 1984. In July of 1984, he filed a workers' comp claim. And then when he went back within his 60 days that he was supposed to go back to work, he was told there were no available jobs. The employee records that I think plaintiffs exhibit, I believe it's number 9, says it was a reduction in workforce was the thing they put down. Noemi Pettis said that when she talked to Gary Dow, the supervisor for the plaintiff, about whether they were going to bring Mr. Alvarado back, Mr. Dow said, well, or said, doesn't he have a lawyer? Why did he get a lawyer? And laughed. Now that's beginning to look like, well, his getting a lawyer and a workers' comp claim may have something to do with it. It's not very strong yet. But there's something else that plaintiff was relying on, I believe, in this case. It's a fair reliance. In the deposition of Mark Ross, Mark Ross had said, when people are injured on the job, employees are injured on the job, we will not take those people back so long as they have limitations on them. And they have to be 100%, have to have 100% medical release. And the limitations that the doctors had placed on Mr. Alvarado, he was questioned about, were two. One, that he could not stand still for long periods of time. And secondly, he couldn't sit for long periods of time. Walking, that sort of thing was all right. It wasn't the standing, it was standing still. He was asked, are those limitations? And he said, yes, they are. They are limitations that are not 100% medical release. Well, now, what import was that to plaintiff? What import would that be in the testimony of the case? Well, you just have to ask yourself, who filed workers' comp claims? People who are injured on the job and people who have limitations or disabilities. If you're not injured on the job or don't have a job-related illness, you don't file a workers' comp claim. You don't have basis for it. If you have no limitations to your ability to earn, I suppose you could file one. You're not going to get very far with it. So what Mark Ross was telling her is that people who have, whether they file a claim or not, he won't go that far. All the witnesses said, oh no, we would never tell a witness not to go, or to an employee not to go to a doctor and not to file comp things, that sort of thing, because that's against the state's law. They're not going to tell them that. But if they make you have 100% release, and if they won't take you back and re-employ you or recall you until you're 100% without any limitations, those are the people who file comp claims. Those are the people, and they're using the comp claim. So that was a little more evidence that plaintiff had to rely on. Well, the witnesses that plaintiff had called from the defendant, Gary Dow was one, Grace Vera, and Teddy Martinez, and I think there's one other. I can't remember the name right offhand. All had said, no, we don't do that. We don't do that. Plaintiff's lawyer had to make a very tactical decision at this point, figuring, well, I think I've got some evidence in on this. Do I have, and I have enough, I think, to escape a directed verdict. But there's a question, do I have enough really to get to the jury on it? Not to get to the jury, but to support a jury verdict on it. And whatever plaintiff's lawyer's thinking was, she decided she wasn't going to call Mark Ross now, in her case in chief, and have him testify to that, because he had said it on his deposition, pages 29 through 32 of the deposition primarily. What she did was rest her case and then let the defendant put on. Now that was risky, because if the defendant had, and they did make a motion for a directed verdict, but they chose to put on evidence, if they hadn't done that, she wouldn't have been able to call him. unless the court had allowed some reopening or something. But anyway, calling, the defendant calling, during the cross-examination, she questioned him about this. And he said, no, I don't think I said that. And then when she faced him with the deposition itself and the language of the deposition, and that language in the deposition is at page, or not in the deposition, in the statement of facts, pages 287 and 288, he finally said, yes, I said it, but it was in error. And now, plaintiff is really in a box. Now what do I do? He won't, and he just said, I didn't mean that at all. What I meant was they wouldn't be called back to their particular job. Did you say that on your deposition? No, I didn't. Well, you made some errors on your deposition. He said, yeah, one or two. Now, the deposition was done back in, I think it was in 86, if I don't recall. Yes, I have it down. September of 86, the trial was in June of 87. No corrections or amendments or anything had ever been made to that deposition saying that, oh, I've read that over and I made an error. So plaintiff is relying on it, and I think reasonably relying on it, that he is sticking with his deposition. And at that time, they filed the depositions with the court. This one was filed with the court. So now a plaintiff is in a box. What do I do? I've got to rebut that. Well, she's not going to find somebody that will say exactly that. So she called, as her rebuttal witness, Mrs. Arambide. Now, all Mrs. Arambide testified to was almost cumulative of what the plaintiff had said. The only thing that was not cumulative about it was that she said what happened to him happened to me. So it wasn't what happened to the plaintiff. She didn't cumulative say, yeah, it happened to him. She said, no, it happened to me. That I was injured on the job. I missed time at work. I filed a workers' comp claim. And I was fired.
Can't you reasonably expect, Professor, that in most trials that somebody may fudge on their deposition testimony? And isn't that a reasonable expectation in this case when the plaintiff has got the witness sitting out in the hallway under subpoena and they've already talked about at pretrial about what his testimony, her testimony might be? And how do you really have
a... Well, I agree with you. I think the plaintiff is keeping Mrs. Arambide out there in case something like this happens. When you CYA, as we call it, is that saying that, well, you don't have any good cause. Now, here's what I'm saying. I think this court has been applying, now some of the courts of appeals have piddled around with it some, but when you're talking about good cause, I think most of the time you're talking about if you call somebody during your case in chief, you've got to have good cause why you didn't answer that interrogatory properly. It's not good cause why you ought to be able to call the witness now. That doesn't apply in these cases. I think one of your cases, I believe it was this court's case, where they said, this was a critical witness. I'm sorry it's a critical witness, counsel, but why didn't you answer your interrogatory properly? And I think that applies to the case in chief. But if a reasonably unexpected development, and I think that in response to what you're saying, Justice Heck, this is a reasonably unexpected. Yeah, she knows it's possible they might back out on something. She had two other witnesses there in case somebody else did, but she didn't call them or have to call them. But this one she did.
But doesn't that kind of standard foster the same gamesmanship that the court's been trying to get away from in discovery and trial?
I would hope that what it would foster, Your Honor, is... that all sides would supplement their discovery, and if there are corrections to be made in a deposition, that you correct those before you get on the witness stand. That wasn't done here. And plaintiff couldn't force them to correct it. She can try to impeach them when they don't. And she did impeach him, and he just said, oh, it was error. But now she has to get, there's the technical thing now that used to be that impeachment with a deposition wasn't any substantive evidence in the case. Now the rules seem to provide that, well, it is. You know, if it's from a deposition, that's not hearsay, and therefore even the impeachment. But it's awfully weak, I think, before a jury. And I think under those, that is enough of an unexpected situation. Is there reasonable, or is there good cause now, a different good cause, to allow you, even though you didn't answer that, to call this witness to rebut the reasonable expectation? And I think there is. And another factor that goes with it, and this is the factor that, again, is battered around. This court has used it, not spoken to it much since then, but the courts of appeals have, and that is this factor of surprise. Well, I don't think surprise has much to do at all with why you don't answer. You can't say, well, I'm not going to answer that, tell them about that witness because they already know about it, and that's not going to do it. But now, if the trial judge had to decide, should I allow them to recall this witness? Well, something unexpected has happened, and I think reading the record of the trial court, you'll see that the trial court recognizes something unexpected had happened. I'm going to allow you to recall if, or particularly in light of the fact that you know about this witness, not that you know they're going to call, well, they knew about it because they've been subpoenaed and they fussed about that part of it, but also they've taken the deposition of this person.
Looks I have two quick questions. You stated that interrogatory number two was, in effect, referring to or conditioned upon interrogatory number one. Did it specifically state for those parties listed in interrogatory?
No.
So there was
no, it did not.
Okay. And your rebuttal witness also had a suit pending at the same time. I don't know if this is in the record, but in the answers to interrogatories which had been filed by the rebuttal witness in her lawsuit, did she list the petitioner in your case as a witness?
I have no earthly idea. I know it's not in the record. That's why I don't know, because I've got the same record before me.
Can you say that the defendant provoked this testimony?
Well, that's what I'm saying. In effect, by not supplementing the interrogatory or the deposition timely and saying we made it, there was an error in there, so that the plaintiff could say, well, now I've got to do something. But by relying on it and then changing it at the trial unexpectedly, I think that provoked it. Now, I'm saying the further good come because they weren't surprised. That made it also goes to what it's harmful error. But I see them totally stopped.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Culp will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court. This is an appeal from the Court of Appeals, wherein the trial court judgment was reversed and remanded. The judgment against Fair Manufacturing Company was for $140,000 in actual damages and $1 million in exemplary damages. This is in a case where counsel just admitted that there was concerns about whether a directed verdict would be avoided. The basis of the claim in this case was that Fair Manufacturing had terminated recall rights. Fair Manufacturing contends that this was a legal obligation on their part. Mr. Lerma contends that it was the result of or was motivated by the filing of a workers' compensation claim. I think it's important to note that Mr. Lerma admitted that he could not continue to perform his old job. The Court of Appeals reversed and remanded based upon two evidentiary errors. One was with respect to a witness who had not been disclosed in answers to interrogatories, and the other related to a multi-million-dollar judgment that a FARA board member had obtained. There are really two issues for this court. One, whether the Court of Appeals was correct on the evidentiary rulings, and the other, whether that was harmful error requiring a reversal and remand. If this court disagreed with the Court of Appeals decision, then FARA Manufacturing Company would respectfully request a remand to the Court of Appeals on the issues not considered there. Counsel has urged that Ms. Arambidi's name was not properly disclosed in answer to interrogatories. I think that this is inaccurate and that a careful reading, or not even a careful reading, any reading of those interrogatories would indicate to the contrary. The interrogatory asked for an identification of people with knowledge of occurrences made the basis of the suit. It also asked for an identification of potential witnesses. When counsel for Mr. Lerma initially sought the admission of the testimony, she represented to the trial court that there were two purposes for the testimony. One was to enhance the prospects for the recovery of exemplary damages, as well as to enhance the prospects for the amount of that exemplary damage recovery. The second basis was that to show that Fair Manufacturing's termination of recall rights was motivated based upon the filing of a workers' compensation claim. Now, both of those issues were at issue from the very outset of the case. And a question that asked for knowledge of occurrences made the basis of the suit when the purpose of the testimony being offered is on issues that have been outstanding and an issue from the very outset would require Ms. Arambidi's disclosure of her name. This is not a case where they did not know Ms. Arambidi, they didn't know where she was at, they had her name throughout, and her name was properly, should have been responded to in the interrogatories that were posed.
Counsel, are you saying that Ms. Arambidi had knowledge of occurrences?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I understood the counsel for the petitioner say that all she testified was about what happened to her.
Well,
not what happened to the plaintiff in this case.
That's true, but it was offered for the basis of showing Fair Manufacturing Company's motivations with respect to the termination of recall rights. And that is an essential element of a wrongful discharge claim under Article 83.07C. And I think that if you're going to present a person to show that motivation, and that's an essential element, to me that's a person with knowledge of occurrences made the basis of the suit. Certainly I think that's the case, but regardless, the second interrogatory asks for potential witnesses. It is not tied to the immediately preceding one by any means whatsoever. And as has been noted in the previous argument, this witness was subpoenaed prior to trial. There was argument prior to trial that this witness was going to give testimony. There was no doubt in anybody's mind that this person was going to testify beforehand. They subpoenaed them. They argued about it before any evidence was offered. This was clearly a potential witness, clearly within the ambit of those interrogatory questions. She was not disclosed. They had knowledge of her name. They had knowledge of her location. So I don't think there's any question that her name comes within the ambit of those interrogatories as they were drafted. So I think that the argument that Ms. Arambidi is not a proper person to be disclosed in response to those interrogatories, given the nature of the suit, given that she was already there, given the elements in an exemplary damage suit that was asserted from the very beginning. Counsel argues when she seeks the admission of that testimony that's being admitted for that purpose. That's a potential witness. There's just no doubt about it. I don't see that there's a genuine argument there. Now,
I understand this undisclosed witness had a similar claim against the same defendant.
That's not part of the record, and I was not the trial lawyer involved in this case or in the other case, but that is also my understanding outside of the record.
Well, the Court of Appeals says that as much.
It may be. I'm not sure. I don't.
Counsel, I thought you said a moment ago that was the case. That what she testified to was that the same thing that happened to her and that happened to this petitioner.
Right. I'm not sure whether... I understand there was a lawsuit filed. I'm not sure if that's in the record.
But, well, my question is, if your client was aware that she had a similar lawsuit pending against him for a similar occurrence, it really didn't come as any surprise to them that she would testify to that, is that correct?
Well, yeah, I think it really does, because when you ask a question about potential witnesses, you want to know all the people that potentially are going to come in and testify against you, and then you make a basis and evaluation of the case based on that. I don't think that the Fair Manufacturing necessarily had any warning that this witness was going to come and testify in this particular case. It was another case. There was no reason. In fact, there was probably some decent arguments that it was not a substantially similar or same circumstance to have allowed it in the first place. But that argument wasn't made. But in terms of surprise, yeah, I think it was surprising that this witness came in and testified in this case. But I suppose that the other response to that is that in the court, in establishing the rule here, has made it real clear that the emphasis is not on surprise, but the emphasis is why the answers were not previously supplied. And the focus is upon what's the excuse. And I would submit to the court that there was no excuse for not answering these questions when this witness was a properly disclosed person, regardless of what occurred at trial. There's no excuse for not having been done before.
What is your response to his statement that interrogatory number two refers to interrogatory number one?
It's just not what it says. There's nothing in that interrogatory that suggests it's referring back to the preceding interrogatory. It's clear on its face that it's not.
Were there any interrogatories that referred to a previous interrogatory?
I couldn't answer that without my head.
In other words, I was curious if there were any interrogatories that contained the statement, you know, please answer and refer back to interrogatory number 30.
I haven't looked at the record with that question in mind. I can't answer that. Now, there is a question here, and it's not really been raised yet, but one that's been addressed in some of the recent decisions of this court on this topic, about the role or the impact of a trial court's discretion in finding good cause. What I would submit to the court is that where there is no basis for an explanation for why Ms. Arambidi's name was not previously disclosed, and where she clearly was known and clearly would have been responsive throughout the entire case, that there's simply no record at all for a trial court to exercise any discretion, did not follow guiding rules and principles that were in place, put in place by this court, and therefore, based on this record, there would be no discretion. I also think that that needs to be the rule in this case, particularly since the concluding remarks by the trial judge prior to the time that he offered and allowed this testimony was, in the interest of justice and getting everything on the table, that he was going to go ahead and allow the testimony. To me, that indicates the trial judge is not applying the good cause standard at all. And if he is going to indicate to the court on the record that he's applying the interest of justice standard and getting everything on the table, then the amount of deference this court should give to that discretion should be very limited, if any. Another point that I would like to point out in this area of the good cause record is that the entire record is based upon the unsworn testimony of the counsel. And the problem that an appellate lawyer and appellate courts have when you have unsworn testimony of lawyers is that it becomes very difficult to distinguish argument from fact. The facts relating to good cause versus what the counsel wants to argue about good cause. And as you start to address the claims of surprise in this case, based upon what was asserted that prior to the offering any evidence, and then when at this rebuttal stage when it was offered, it's fairly clear that a number of the contentions raised by trial counsel were disingenuous. There was just an effort to try and manufacture some form of surprise so that she could get this witness in based upon the failure to have properly disclosed answers previously. And I think that the court ought to consider setting forth some more formal rules rather than allowing lawyers out of one side of their mouth talk about argument and then the other side of their mouth talk about facts. And I think we've got that problem in trying to evaluate good cause as it relates to this case. In the recent decision by this court in Clark versus Trailways, it's indicated that good cause in this context requires a showing of an inability to anticipate the use of the testimony of the unidentified witness as the basis for meeting the good cause requirement. I think that it is very clear in this case, given the subpoena on the witness beforehand, given the fact that there was argument before any evidence was ever offered, that they anticipated the use of this witness well in advance of the trial and yet didn't disclose. And I think for that reason, the good cause standard was not met. I think this is particularly true when it's clear that this witness had knowledge of material facts, as counsel argued.
Counsel, I'm not clear on one thing. At what point did your side know about the existence of this witness?
At the pretrial conference, there was a discussion, that's within 30 days of trial.
Okay.
There was a discussion about other parties coming in to testify about other claims to support this case.
How far in advance of trial?
I believe it was on May, it was less than 30 days, 20 days, something like that. There was a pretrial conference where this was
and first. Did you know at that time what the substance of this witness that's in dispute here would be or what they were listed for? Or were they listed?
That Ms. Aaron Beatty was not specifically disclosed in that pretrial conference.
What do you mean by specifically?
I'm sorry?
What do you mean by specifically?
There was a general reference to third claims of other third parties treated similarly and the, whether or not the court ought to allow such testimony. That was generally addressed. It was addressed in the context of whether the same or similar circumstances were sufficient to justify admission of evidence. But there wasn't a specific identification of Ms. Aaron Beatty.
When did that first identification occur?
To my knowledge, based upon the record before the court, and I don't have any other knowledge,
yeah,
it was immediately before the trial, before the offering of evidence.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals specifically states in the opinion on page 532, at the pretrial hearing, the appellee advocated for the admission of Arambita's testimony in order to prove the appellant had in the past violated Article 8307C. This indicates to me that Arambita's name was mentioned in the pretrial hearing.
I don't believe that the record before the court indicates that. That's my best recollection, that there was a discussion generally about...
Were you saying the Court of Appeals is an error?
With respect to that statement, I believe that that's the case.
But the trial court did decide at the pretrial hearing that he was going to allow testimony of other folks who were similarly situated, didn't he?
At the pretrial conference?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if there was a specific decision. Certainly there was an indication... Because they weren't dealing with specific people, I'm not sure the court was willing to make a decision without specific circumstances in mind. My recollection is he didn't make it, but I think he gave some indications that he was going to.
Was the subpoena issued before the trial or during the course of the trial?
I believe the record indicates it was issued and served before the trial.
Are you going to discuss the harmless error? Assuming you're correct and everything else, so
yes.
What? Is it error harmless or is it harmful?
Yes, I'd like to. There's one other point that I'd like to make that I think is very significant in this context, and it relates to Mark Ross's alleged surprise testimony. A lot has been made of whether there was surprise, whether his testimony was inconsistent or not. I've dealt with that in a brief. Quite frankly, you get into such an argument of semantics here that it's difficult to address in oral context. I don't think that this inconsistency is all that great. But I think what is and should be dispositive for this court is the admission in respondent's application to this court to the effect that Aaron Beaton's testimony was not intended and did not directly refute the surprise testimony of Mark Ross. I think that is a very critical admission. If
on the green light.
The green
was not intended and did not directly refute the surprise testimony of Mark Ross. I think that is a very critical admission. If you are going to allow a good cause exception to the rule of exclusion, then certainly this court should limit the people or the circumstances who are going to testify that would be in response to what the alleged surprise testimony is. If you don't make such a limitation, then what you're going to have is what I think we have here in this case. Tremendous effort made to try and manufacture some inconsistency, which then opens the door toward avoiding an error in failing to disclose somebody's name prior to the trial. if we're going to allow witnesses and information on a good cause exception, then there must be some relationship to the evidence and to the people that are allowed in regard to the good cause. And I would submit, given that admission to this court, that there is none as to Mr. Andy's testimony. With respect to the harmful error issue as it relates to this evidentiary point, the recent cases of this court on this subject tend to emphasize two things. One is whether it was cumulative, whether Ms. Arambidi's testimony was merely cumulative, and the other I will characterize as simply whether or not the evidence was important. The court has obviously a different, more technical standard than that, but that's what it simply comes down to. I think that it is fairly well admitted that this is not cumulative evidence. I've never heard cumulative evidence characterized quite the way the counsel for Lerma characterized it today. All the testimony prior to Ms. Arambidi's testimony came and dealt with Mr. Lerma's situation. Ms. Arambidi's testimony was about her situation. Now, that's not cumulative. It's a whole new set of facts, a whole new set of fact patterns, which then had to be addressed unexpectedly by Farrell. So this is not cumulative evidence in any sense of the word that I've ever understood. Now, was it important? The things that the court has emphasized in this area is, one, is it an unpaid third-party witness? Yes, this is an unpaid third-party witness. That has been something that's emphasized in some of the court decisions in the past. Another thing that's been emphasized by the court in the past in the harmful error analysis is there direct evidence of the claim, or is this a circumstantial evidence of the claim? Frankly, it's clearly a circumstantial evidence case, and counsel for Lerma's admissions to this court that there was concerns about a directed verdict, I think, highlights the fact that this is very much a circumstantial evidence case, and therefore one that this court ought to more carefully scrutinize in the area of harmful error analysis.
What was that statement? I'm sorry.
Because it's a circumstantial evidence case, the court should more carefully scrutinize
harmful error analysis. Yes, sir. And the thought behind that, I believe, is that the closer the case is, and the more erroneous the evidentiary admission is, then the more carefully this court ought to consider whether or not it was harmful error or not. Frankly, I think the overwhelming evidence was that Fair Manufacturing did nothing more than assert its legal obligations and apply the legal obligations it had under the collective bargaining agreement. The last thing I'd point out to the court is that when admission of this evidence was sought, counsel for Lerma said, I want to enhance exemplary damages. They got $1 million judgment for exemplary damages in this case. This court has frequently found harmful error in the context of that large of exemplary damage finding. This court in G versus Liberty Mutual and Rainbow Baking versus Stafford has indicated that the goal of the rule of exclusion is to encourage full discovery so that realistic assessment of the case can be made and to prevent trial by ambush. The consequence of the trial court's decision in this case was that Fair Manufacturing assessed its responsibilities and liability exposure based upon trying one case, and what occurred was they were tried by ambush in two cases. I think it's clear that this is harmful error and that it was in fact it. Counsel did not address the second evidentiary issue in his argument, and I don't know whether this court wants me to go forward to address it or not. I don't really have anything to respond to. I said it all in the brief. I'd be happy to address it if the court would like me to.
Apparently not.
Okay. The only thing I would say in closing then is that in the event that the court does disagree with the Court of Appeals decision, we would respectfully request that the court remand to the Court of Appeals for it to consider those points that it did not address that were presented to that court below.
Are there factual insufficiency points? Or just
yes, Your Honor. There are some factual insufficiency points.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I would first of all, if I I might go back to this harmful error thing, because I think it's very important in this case if the court were to decide, first of all, that it was error not to name this witness to start with. And I'm always leery, as I said, of saying these sort of things. I think the court may say, yes, it should have been named. I think there's good reason not to say that, but I think the court may. I am thinking that when you get to the whether or not under these circumstances where you have something you should be able to reasonably expect will be the testimony, and then that is not the testimony, then someone you have not named might be able to be called, if there's good cause for it, to rebut that testimony. And here I think that situation arose. Someone who was not named was allowed to be called because of this unexpected, and unexpected based on reason, not just I didn't think it had happened. And I think there was good cause for it, because the trial court said, all right, I'm going to let you do it. And what did the trial court do? First of all, the trial court was assured by the attorneys, if not by testimony, and both sides, that the defense lawyer had deposed this witness, was not going to be surprised by anything this witness had to say, and also the defense was allowed to call two rebuttal witnesses of its own to rebut plaintiff's rebuttal. Now, Justice Ray may recall a case a long time ago when you were up on the Court of Appeals up in Texarkana. I think you wrote a dissent to it, and I can't even remember the name of the case. It's terrible. I mean, it's just where the plaintiff complained about rebuttal to plaintiff's rebuttal. And your court said, wait a minute, that wasn't rebuttal. You reopened. Now, you may be right when you rebut. They don't get to rebut your rebuttal because plaintiff has the right to open and close the evidence. But if you reopen, we're going to give them the right to rebut you. Well, here, nobody complained about it, but they were allowed to rebut her testimony. But also, I think the court's got to look at this factor. You have said in the G case that what you're going to look at is this is like inadmissible evidence, and you're going to look at it that way. Was it cumulative, and I think you said, was it important? Fair characterization of it. Here we're not talking, though, about inadmissible evidence. If you were talking about inadmissible evidence, when it's remanded for trial, they're not going to be able to use it. What's going to happen if this is remanded for trial? They're going to name Autumn, be they? She's going to testify. You know, what's going to be the difference? I think what you have to look at, and that's why surprise in the context of harm is a very important factor. What difference is it going to make from this trial the way it was tried and a remand of this for this reason? Are they harmed by her testimony at this trial?
So why do we need the rule? We don't really need the rule.
Well, Judge, if they didn't allow the testimony, you've got a whole different situation. But I think, yes, you would, Judge. Had this witness been a total surprise to you, they didn't know what to cross-examine or what she was going to say, and couldn't call rebuttal witnesses to her, you know, they might have a good claim that, well, you know, we were hurt by this.
Doesn't that just reward stupidity and practice of law? Judge, I'm too stupid to know what's going to go on in this trial, so please don't let them call this witness. I mean, if any lawyer who's carefully prepared his case, he's going to be suspicious of everything, isn't he?
Well, I think, yes, they're, you know, suspicious of everything. Certainly you could say, well, he was subpoenaed. And by the way, the name Autumn Bealey we did find was mentioned in the pretrial hearing that I think you asked about that. That the name Jocelyn Autumn Bealey was mentioned.
Would you say that our rules then, like a plaintiff's attorney cannot testify, some attorney cannot testify on attorney's fees if his name isn't listed. We should just scrap that on kind of a practicality argument?
Judge, no, I'm not saying that. I think what you need to do is to look at each one of them and say, look, all right, you call this, well, first of all,
we want to give the trial court some guidance, some rules.
I understand you do.
Also want to give them some discretion, too.
Well, I think that's true, too. And you know, if you get the rule so hard, they don't have any discretion left when things happen. But when you're, an undisclosed witness is called, and if there's no question about that, you should have, it's wrong, you shouldn't have done it, and it was error. Given that, let's give that situation. Now you've got to look at, was it harmful? That's what you were looking at in G. And in G, you used a particular test that you look for. You used the same test for inadmissible evidence. But I'm saying that when you have a non-disclosed witness, if it's someone that has testified and you're going to remand it, they're going to supplement the interrogatories and they're going to testify at the next one. Now, that alone
is
not...
We don't necessarily know there's going to be a remand here. I mean, that's up to Court of Appeals.
Well, Court of Appeals is remanded. If you claim it, you've got a remand.
That's right.
Sure.
It's already been
remanded. It's been remanded. Now, that alone, you don't say, oh, well, so that's bull. Let's just forget about that stuff. No. You have to see, well, what position was the attorney who's complaining about this? Are they in any different position, or were they in any different position at the actual trial of this case than they will be in any future trial of the case? And where there was no surprise, the attorney had deposed this witness for another case yet, but about the very fact that were testified to in this one, and where the attorney was allowed...
The same attorney has deposed?
Yes, the same attorney. And where they... there were these two rebuttal witnesses allowed to be called, which, you know, you might not be allowed to do that when you get back to the, at least in the rebuttal situation. But when you examine all that, were they really harmed by it? And I don't think they were harmed at all. I would like to very quickly mention something, and if counsel feels like he would like to respond to it, I have no objection to it. It's up to the court, obviously. But on that... the complaint about the Willie Farr thing, that's the biggest, it's the biggest mess I ever saw. Apparently, this witness, who was not plaintiff's witness, plaintiff was cross-examining this witness, though called during her case in chief, testified something that wasn't true. Was asked if this Willie Farr, or Fair, whatever they pronounce it, got a judgment. He said yes. And it was, in fact, apparently, according to the Court of Appeals, it was a judgment by the company for some however million dollars it was. Well, the jury heard some untrue testimony by one of their witnesses, and they're complaining about it. Also, the thing that worries me most is that they said the jury was misled by this into thinking, well, the company's got all this money, and therefore we can handle it. There is nothing in this record that I have seen that shows anybody that this jury was misled. It kind of looks at juries, well, if you get some improper evidence in front of you that said an individual got money, you're going to think, oh my gosh, that means the company had money. Now, I don't know why you make those kind of leaps with juries or those kind of people. And secondly, one of the things that's also not before this court, because it wasn't asked to be brought before the court, are the arguments of counsel at the trial. And I'm sure the trial court, in denying the motion for new trial on this point, must have heard how counsel for the others for the defense argued and explained to the jury, look, so he got some money, that doesn't, and so to prevent the jury from being misled. And how the conclusion was on the court's part, Court of Appeals, that the jury was misled. Where that comes from, just because there was other evidence in the case from the same witness that Farr Manufacturing Company was in a good financial position. They were a Wall Street firm and had assets over $1 million. Now, they didn't object to that. Now, I grant you that doesn't tell you anything. Oh, well, there's some evidence of net worth. You've got to get the liabilities in here, but the plaintiff didn't bring up the liabilities. That's up, I suppose, to the defendant to do it. The court hadn't quite decided how you get in evidence of net worth yet. But this is some evidence of it, not a whole lot. But I just say that's a thing that the confusion on that is great, I grant. I think that has no real basis.
Any questions? Mr. Colt, do you desire to respond? I'd be happy to if the court would like me to. Does anybody wish to do that?
That wasn't one we granted on, was it?
Pardon?
That wasn't one we, that wasn't the point we granted on, was it?
I think we
did
on all but one. Yes, because it was one of the 2 points that they said was reversible error in the court of appeals, and so they were all challenged.
Leave it to the brief.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you to both counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause, and the court will take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.